Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, June 20th, 2017, starting just after 12:21 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 113th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Nicholas Campion from the University of Wales Trinity St. David about the revival of the practice of astrology in the early 20th century. Nick, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. In my last episode, I did an interview with a friend about the life and work of the famous 20th century astrologer Dane Rudyard, and we talked about his work in reviving astrology in the 20th century. But in order to do that, we had to briefly sort of gloss over the fact that there was a decline of astrology from the 17th century onwards. And then we couldn't really spend much time talking about and contextualizing the revival of astrology in the 20th century, why it needed to be revived, or indeed how that happened. So I thought that you would be a great person to talk to because you're essentially the foremost historian on the history of astrology, both Western astrology as well as just astrology as a practice in the world in general at this point, I think, right?
Yes, I've got many friends and colleagues who probably specialize much more in areas in which they are the undoubted experts. But I think my particular contribution is to draw together strands and themes from the entire history of astrology and look at the big picture.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your work because your work on the history of astrology and some of your books, especially one of your early books, Astrology, History, and Apocalypse, actually ignited my interest and my love in studying the history of astrology over the years. So I really owe you in terms of that, and I'm excited about having this discussion today.
No, thanks, Chris. That's really good to hear. It's teaching that actually makes all this work worthwhile, and students picking up the baton and then taking it forward, like as you were doing.
Definitely. All right. Well, let's jump right into the discussion then. So part of the context is that astrology was flourishing in Europe during the Renaissance, but then by the time of the 17th century, there was a downward trend of some sort, right?
That's correct. And it was quite rapid. We're really looking at Western Europe here, France, Germany, Britain in particular, where astrology had been a vital part of Renaissance culture, Italy as well, of course, and Spain. Astrology had been unquestioned. It had operated at all levels of society and culture. And that was the situation which we had in the year 1600. And the first few decades, the 1600s, by the year 1700, all that had changed. Sometime around the end of the first part of the 16th century, around the 1650s, suddenly it was as if the zeitgeist in Europe shifted. And suddenly astrology was seen as a ridiculous part of an old world that people were leaving behind.
Sure. And oftentimes, I mean, in retrospect, especially in contemporary discussions, this is usually said to have been due to the scientific revolution and science suddenly disproving astrology at that point in the 17th century. But you've actually, it seems like in some of your works, you've pushed back on that narrative and pointed out that there were other social and political things going on at the same time as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, science only tells part the story. Look, these are the very, very early days of what we now consider to be science. Belief in God in Christian countries was universal. You have one or two people saying, "I'm an atheist," but it's really just one or two people. You know, the world was very, very different, almost unimaginable in modern terms. And so science never disproved astrology. You know, we have people in the 20th century who've done statistical tests that they claim come out with negative results for astrology. Such tests didn't exist in the 17th century. What seems to have happened is that there's a kind of astrology was attacked and became discreditable. And that's the kind of astrology which requires the casting of horoscopes and the very, very detailed calculation of destinies and futures and possibilities. And the attack on that kind of astrology was not nearly so much due to emerging science as to the fact that astrologers got some major predictions wrong. So what we have to do, Chris, is to understand a very useful distinction between two kinds of astrology. On the one hand, there's what we call natural astrology, which deals with the seasons, with cycles, with rhythms, with the body. And then there's what we call judicial astrology. It's judicial because the astrologer makes a judgment. And the astrologer makes a judgment by sort of looking at a horoscope, often a birth chart or a chart cast for the asking of a question. And often the judgments they make can be very, very detailed, finding lost property, deciding whether they're to treat somebody's illness, working out when they're going to get married. Now, the idea of a general connection, a natural connection between the stars, planets, and affairs on Earth was universally accepted. Nobody doubted it. But the idea that you could then move from there to saying, well, we need to treat you using this particular herb, or your lost property is over there in the next field, or you're going to get married at the age of 28. A lot of people had always doubted whether you could go to that level of detail. And from the late 15th century onwards, astrologers made a few high-profile forecasts, which turned out to be wrong. And the critics of astrology then came in and said, okay, well, we all know there are these natural connections, but you can't make these statements of detail. And this is a process that is underway in the early 1500s. And the astrologers respond in several ways. Some of them say, oh, well, those critics, they don't understand astrology. They just don't get it. They don't really know what we're doing. They carry on as before. There's another group who say, well, yeah, you know, astrology does get it wrong. There are reasonable criticisms. And so what we need to do is go back to the old texts, look at the proper material and work out how to do it better and get rid of the newer material that we don't like so much. And it what they did often was they went back to the classical Greek texts, particularly to the great second century astrologer Claudius Ptolemy. And a lot of astrologers who are more recent than that, who'd come in, for example, from the Islamic world, they wanted to get rid of and go back to the real stuff.
Right. So that was part of the back to Ptolemy movement, where when there's a conflict in doctrines between two techniques, oftentimes Lilly will opt to go with Ptolemy rather than the later, what he perceived as the later Islamic tradition or something like that, right?
That's exactly right. So Ptolemy became the great authority you couldn't disagree with, and anything later could then be more suspect. But there were other currents going on. Okay, I think there's two other ways in which the astrologers reacted. One was to say, we have to throw out all of astrology completely and build an empirical astrology based on the observation of correlations between events and planetary cycles. And it was Johann Kepler who took this up immediately before William Lilly. And although he could work as a traditional astrologer, he said, let's get rid of houses, get rid of zodiac signs, and just work with planetary aspects. And he made sample predictions through the year. And at the end of the year, he'd look back and see if they came out correct. And I think there was another trend as well, which was the magical. Often magic is considered as something separate to astrology, but it's just not. There is magical astrology. And I think this kind of astrology, it's not often considered part of the astrological mainstream. I don't know why, but it's very much concerned with action. So rather than just reading horoscope and making a forecast, in the magical tradition, you act with it. You try to somehow alter the future. So I think that you've got that diversification going on. So in the 1600s, you've got astrology being very diverse, astrologers arguing in different directions with different theories and different ideas. And suddenly this cumulative idea that making these detailed predictions of when you're going to get married or where your lost property is, suddenly that seemed suddenly to be ridiculous. It was almost like there was a tipping point and people said, we can't take this stuff seriously.
Sure. So there were moves towards reform already with people like Kepler, or to some extent, people with Lilly had their own sort of ideas of what reform looked like. But by that point, the subject was already in decline. And to what extent did cosmological shifts that had been taking place contribute to the sort of new status of astrology, or the falling out of favor in intellectual circles?
It did to an extent. And I think that the biggest influence was the invention of the telescope. Around 1609, Galileo made his first great observations through a telescope. He wrote them up in 1610, and they had a real electrifying effect in intellectual culture in Europe. And so I think what happened was this, that when you draw out a horoscope, you draw in the medieval style, you know, a square chart with lines on it. You've got the planetary glyphs on it. And then you know where the aspects are. And if you don't draw them on, the planets have got weighting. The horoscope can be analysed in ever more complex ways. When you look through a telescope at the sky, you don't see any of that stuff. You just see the planets moving. And not only that, through a telescope, you see that Venus has phases, Jupiter has moons, and Saturn has rings. So the whole way in which the planets were represented previously suddenly turns out to be kind of incorrect and not really in line with the wonderful things that people were discovering. But a lot of people were up for actually the creation of a new astrology. This was not a complete rejection of astrology in many ways, but a reform. And there were people throughout the 1600s saying, look, we can make a new astrology that's closer to a natural astrology, you know, dealing with more natural influences, cycles, empirical observation, and so on. It's just that this wasn't the time. I mean, the idea that the moon influences our psychological and physical states was current in medicine throughout the 1700s. And that's something that's very difficult to challenge, because you know the moon's physical influence is so obvious. You know, you live in a coastal area, you can see the tides. So it's so obvious that it's really natural then to say, well, it must affect our humours and moods as well. So that idea didn't disappear. So the idea of natural connections between people and the sky, stars, and planets just, you know, continued. It was the casting of horoscopes which kind of collapsed throughout all the cultures in Europe that had regarded astrology very highly.
Sure. And to some extent, one of the things you talk about is that the cosmology of Claudius Ptolemy that was set down in the second century, and which had acted as sort of an explanatory, not just an explanatory thing, but something that made astrology permissible because it could be rationalized in the Middle Ages in a natural context. But that by the time you reach the 16th and 17th centuries, where Ptolemy's cosmology is suddenly disproven or seriously challenged, that that in and of itself, because astrology was so closely wrapped up in it, also cast serious doubt on the validity of astrology at that point?
That's right. Indeed, you know, if astrology had been based on the idea of the Earth as the center of the cosmos, and suddenly the sun is the center of the cosmos, then a large part of its physical model is destroyed. Actually, it collapses. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether that's not fatal for astrology, actually, because we can see the way in which astrology flourishes in the 20th century in the West, because people rationalize the fact that the Earth is the center of horoscope in a different way. They say, no, it's the person that is the center of their own universe. And of course, in India, even though the modern scientific cosmos is understood, the practice of astrology remains very much very like it was in Europe until the 17th century. It's very parallel. There are differences, but in its complexity and the way it works, it's very parallel, and that flourishes in the modern world. So there's no essential reason why the new cosmology should have destroyed the old astrology. It was almost as if the old astrology was just somehow waiting to be pushed over. And of course, on top of that, you've got centuries of hostility from conservative Christian forces who, at the conservative ends of the church, had always been very uncomfortable with judicial astrology, always very suspicious and wary of the idea that you could make detailed predictions using astrology, largely because it challenged God's universal power to control the future. And so I think there'd been centuries of criticism. Judicial astrology had always had its critics, its opponents. And so when the 17th century came along, finally it couldn't stand any more criticism. It had not just conservative theologians against it, but also it had the new breed of astronomers and telescope users. So it's facing opponents on two fronts.
Sure. So that's part of the sort of diverse social and political and scientific sort of storm that eventually sort of coalesces and leads to this decline of astrology in Europe in the 17th century. Although there's one last sort of pocket of activity, which is taking place in England with William Lilly and some of his contemporaries around the mid 17th century, right?
The mid 17th century, I think it was still a time when astrology was flourishing in France, Germany, equivalent cultures in Europe. But they were the last flowering. So with William Lilly, it's interesting that he published the first great astrological textbook in the English language in 1647. And of course, this comes close to marking the collapse of judicial astrology is a respectable practice. Well, a few decades later. I actually see Lilly as a bit of a reformer, because I think he published Christian Astrology, his great textbook, because he believed in education, and he published it in English because he wanted it to be accessible. So I think I would class him as a reformer a little bit in that sense.
Sure. And that makes sense. And I actually had a question about that, because I think you refer to it as the first English language textbook on astrology published in 1647. And somebody, I think I had like a reviewer when I cited that, sort of challenged me whether that was true. And I haven't been able really to find anything else except for maybe pamphlets or something. But you feel pretty confident that really is the first major textbook on astrology in English?
I do. There were previous books on astrology in English. You're right. There were pamphlets. There were books about astrology. But this is a major teaching manual. Hundreds of example charts on mainly nativities and horary questions that a student can use to perfect their craft, following chapters that set out the basic delineations. So it's a very, very major teaching book. And I can't think of anything equivalent prior to 1647.
Right. So that is an important turning point, just because books up to that point were in Europe were usually written in Latin. So suddenly you're saying he writes this book in English, partially in order to make it easier for sort of normal people to learn astrology. And in that way, he acts as sort of a reformer in some sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very close parallel with Thomas Culpeper, the famous herbalist and astrologer, who also wrote in English for the same reason. So, you know, Culpeper was a great radical. He was a Republican, supporter of the English Revolution. I read one of his political pamphlets once where he said that he didn't care if his predictions were true or not, so long as they encouraged the enemies of monarchy. And so he got into a bit of trouble for publishing medical information in English because he was breaking the educated monopoly on it. You know, but amongst, you know, the idea was that you had to be able to read Latin to possess such knowledge. Culpeper said, no, I'm writing in English for everybody. And so this puts Lilly's English writing into some kind of context. They're saying we want everybody to be able to have access to this material.
Okay. So despite those efforts and that sort of late flourishing of astrology, it's still basically on its way out in Europe, and it reaches a low point eventually in the 18th and early 19th century, right?
Yeah. So I think we should put the decline, you know, the last few decades of the 1600s, really. And then, yeah, in the 18th century, there seems to have been a little tradition of the casting of horoscopes in England, which hung on barely. And I suspect there might have been other practices in Germany or France, but maybe the records are lost. Historians haven't found them. I'd be surprised if there weren't. You know, that this knowledge must have somehow hung on, particularly as other sort of mystical, magical currents continued, such as Rosicrucianism and occult esoteric strands in Freemasonry. So I'd be very surprised if there was no other horoscopic astrology surviving anywhere in Europe. But as far as we know, at the moment, there's just a little lineage surviving in England until we get to the end of the 18th century. And in particular, a man called Ebenezer Sibley publishes another great textbook on astrology in English. And in a way, this is the first revival, if you like, or the proto-revival. From then on, from the 1780s onwards, we do then get a little network of people who are publishing books and talking about astrology. The fact that Sibley published his great book on astrology means that people must have bought it. So there must have been a market, maybe a small market. But Sibley's brother, Manoah Sibley, also an esotericist, was a follower of Emanuel Swedenborg, the Swedish visionary, who argued that the kingdom, the spiritual kingdom of Christ, had already begun. So there was a culture of esotericists, occultists, or, you know, already around and present in the late 18th century. In fact, I'm sure it never died out. So those people provided the basis revival interest in the casting of horoscopes.
Okay, but in terms of the broader sort of public perception of astrology or public consciousness, even though there may have been some sort of like fringe groups or fringe elements, especially in some of the esoteric strands that were keeping the practice alive, that for the most part, this was not something that was widely practiced. And there was certainly a decline compared to the flourishing during the Renaissance or during the previous centuries, right?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly there was. I just think that a little bit more study needs to go into the esoteric and occultish strands and how they were treating the subject. But of course, Chris, the one area of activity that was completely unaffected was the writing and publishing of almanacs, which you might consider to represent the popular astrology of the day.
Sure. So what did that look like in terms of the almanacs and how were those used in terms of keeping astrology in the public consciousness?
Well, almanacs were like a kind of newspapers published either monthly or annually. They'd contain records of information, weather forecasts, public holidays, so on. So some information is completely non-esoteric. They would all have contained astronomical information, so new and full moons, and some of them moved into being very strongly astrological. And sales were high and remained popular. You know, every household had purchased almanacs. And so on that level, on that popular level, astrology continued as before. So if you spoke to somebody, you know, it's in the mid 17th century about, you know, a zodiac sign or a planet being in a zodiac sign, a full moon, they would have known what you were talking about and might have assumed that this had some kind of general significance. So on that level, there was no change. It's a little bit like, you know, popular astrology now. You read a horoscope column, you maybe know what your birth sign is. You might take it very seriously or you might not. You might have an idea of what it means for you, but that's about it. There's a huge leap between that kind of astrology and the level of detail that comes with the casting of a detailed horoscope.
Okay, so we have the survival of this kind of public or popular form of astrology with almanacs, but you don't necessarily have hundreds or thousands of astrologers running around casting horary charts or natal charts, or even publishing some of the things that are necessary for that, like tables of houses and other things, right?
That's correct. On that level, this culture of astrology, which had, you know, was so ancient and which had been such a huge part of European cultural life for half a millennium, it just disappeared.
Okay. And then eventually we get to the late 19th century, and we start to the late 19th and early 20th century, and we see this revival of interest in the practice of astrology start to occur. And this was happening within the context or maybe as a result of a rise in interest in other things related to things like the spiritualism movement, as well as the Theosophical Society and the beginnings of the New Age movement, right?
It was partly, but again, let's not forget the diversity. Right throughout the 19th century, there was always a few astrological pioneers who said, look, astrology has nothing to do with the esoteric, nothing to do with the occult. It's scientific in the sense that you can plot the positions of the planets and you can make definite predictions from that, like you can work out when somebody's going to die. Very mechanical kind of astrology. So that had its enthusiasts. And then there is the very important sort of esoteric current. We tend to focus on this in Britain with the rise of the Theosophists after the 1870s. We need to remember what was going on in France as well, a very strong magical tradition in France, and figures like in the late 19th century, such as Eliphas Levi, who were practicing a magical kind of astrology. You perform your magical ritual when the planets or the moon are beneficially aligned. But yes, it's very much carried forward by the Theosophists, and really by one particular man, Alan Leo. At the time, if you'd highlighted Alan Leo like that, there are lots of other astrologers who would have said, "Oh, why is Leo so important?" And actually had people who have got rather annoyed at the fact that he had such a high profile. But in retrospect, I think historically we can see the way that he, through his publishing and his teaching, he helped create a wider appetite for astrology. So he did a number of things, right? He worked through the Theosophical Society, which published his books, and so he made astrology a part of Theosophical culture. Okay, so, you know, the Theosophical Society was founded by Helena Blavatsky in 1875 in New York, and its mission was to revive all the important wisdom of the ancient world to prepare people for the coming of the next phase of spiritual development. And the term for that next age that came in was New Age. So Alan Leo believed that astrology was essential to individual preparation for the New Age. And so he went through a process of completely rejecting the idea of prediction in astrology, because he said, look, prediction only works for people who are ruled by fate. And those are people who lack any spiritual awareness. So, you know, you can work out when somebody's going to get married or get divorced if they're just following their fate. But he said that's not the point. The point about astrology is to teach spiritual self-awareness in order to prepare for the coming of the New Age, the Age of Aquarius, which he thought would begin in the 1920s. And so this drove him, and it helped him create this a culture, if you like. And he founded societies, he founded journals, he founded organizations, and eventually in 1915 he founded a organization called the Astrological Lodge of the Theosophical Society in London, and that still meets every Monday. It's over 100 years old. And that body, the lodge, became the institutional heart of this revival of astrology in the Western world. Other organizations were founded in Germany, because the Germans got going and into this as well, very importantly. And in fact, in terms of Germany, let's mention Carl Jung, because he began studying astrology in 1910, which is 5 years before Leo founded the lodge. Leo died 7 years after Jung began studying astrology. So Jung gets going as well, even though Jung doesn't write much about astrology. It forms a very, very limited part of his entire corpus of writings. The statements he made about it have become incredibly influential in terms of convincing people that astrology has a perfectly reasonable rationale, that it's something that can inform people about their lives in a meaningful way.
Right, and astrologers from the 1930s onward would use and sometimes appropriate Jung's work, you know, as giving sort of an explanatory rationale for astrology. Although actually maybe before we get there, so with Alan Leo, and it seems like part of the reason that he had such a pivotal role, or is attributed such a pivotal role in the revival of astrology, is that he published a number of books where he tried to simplify astrology and make it easier to learn, but also through his connections with the Theosophical Society and their publishing branch, he was able to get them published pretty widely around the English-speaking world, but they were also translated into some other European languages, I think, right?
That's right. That's right. So the Theosophical Society was probably, you know, the most successful New Age organization of them all. It spread across Europe with branches across Europe, America, of course, where it was founded, and it became quite influential in India as well. And so this idea that astrology was a necessary feature of spiritual development was propagated by the Theosophical Society. And of course, as you say, Leo produced a much simpler version of horoscope reading. Actually, in some ways, his interpretation is more complex because of all the spiritual levels he brings in. But the technical side of astrology becomes dramatically simplified. In fact, in this, I would say he's partly following on from the simplifying tendencies of Kepler. He's saying that the very, very complex technical procedures which were characteristic of medieval astrology actually don't get you anywhere. Or they can allow you to make predictions if you are governed by fate. But if you're not governed by fate, you need something looser and more flexible. And so Leo is partly responsible of moving the sun to the center of astrological interpretation. So, you know, if you went to see an astrologer in the Middle Ages, then any one of the planets in the horoscope could be the most important. They might look at the ascendant, and the ascendant might be in Gemini. So they might say, well, you know, Mercury is the most important planet in your chart, just to simplify matters. But the astrology that Leo gave us is one in which the sun is invariably the most important planet. It's the spiritual heart of the universe and the spiritual heart of every individual. So, you know, as a result of Leo, you can go to a conference of astrologers who all know how to cast horoscopes with all the planets, all the signs of zodiac in them, but they will, and I've seen this, you know, on their conference badges have, you know, their sun sign, and perhaps along with their moon sign, a rising sign as well. So that shorthand that Leo encouraged has become very much a part of the culture of, you know, horoscope casting astrologers. And so, yeah, that simplification, I think, has proved very significant, because if there's less to learn in order to read a horoscope, obviously more people can do it.
Right. So it makes it easier to pick up on the part of the student. And then he also had a sort of innovative way of doing sort of mass market astrology delineations as well, that probably helped in terms of the revival and popularization of astrology in the early 20th century, right?
He did. He wrote the what we call shilling horoscopes. So a shilling is a unit of currency in Britain. It's no longer used now, but think of it as a equivalent maybe to about 10 cents. So we could call these the 10-cent horoscopes in dollar terms. And he produced paragraphs for each possible astrological factor. So, you know, Venus in the first house, Venus in the second house, Venus in the third house, and so on. Mars aspected to the sun, Mars aspected to the moon, going through every permutation. And then he had a team of clerical staff who could fit these paragraphs together for people who had sent in their birth data with the shilling or their 10 cents. And this was the first venture we know of. So it was the first venture of its kind that we know of. Certainly, perhaps it was the first. So it's a real innovatory breakthrough. And it's, I think, the beginning of what we now, people came to call cookbook astrology, where, you know, you can learn from a book the different meanings of different zodiac sign and house placements and aspects, and you can fit them all together, which I don't think would have happened in medieval astrology at all. I think it would be a very different way of working.
Sure. So we can see then through those publishing efforts and through that new type of sort of mass market astrology, why he would have had such a huge impact and why he would, you know, be attributed with being such a pivotal figure in the revival of astrology in the early 20th century. There are, you know, he wasn't the only person, though, obviously, that was practicing. And there are other figures like Sepharial and Mark Edmund Jones, who also played some role in terms of the revival of astrology in the early 20th century, though, right?
Oh, there were. Look, let me just give you an anecdote to illustrate this. At the time that Leo founded the Astrological Lodge, there was another astrological society in London, simply called the Astrological Society. And Leo was a member of it, and he was trying to get a lot of theosophy onto the program. And all the other members of the society got really fed up with this. He said, "Alan, you know, keep your theosophy to yourself. We just want to do astrology, the nuts and bolts of it." And they had a big meeting, and the transcript of the meeting is published. And Leo sort of lost the debate, and that's where he went off and founded the Astrological Lodge of the Theosophical Society as a place where astrology and theosophy could marry up. So back in his own time, there was a lot of people who didn't like his approach. But quite a few of the other leading astrologers actually were theosophists or theosophically influenced. So you mentioned Sepharial, real name Walter Gornold. He was also very, very popular. He was a major friend of Madame Blavatsky's. What I find interesting about him, though, is that his astrology was quite mechanical in a traditional sense. He doesn't seem to have at all taken on the idea that one needed to use astrology to elevate oneself spiritually to prepare for the coming of the new age. So theosophy had a different kind of impact on his astrology, if any impact at all. I'm not sure if it did. But he was big, he was popular, he wrote books on everything, horror astrology, weather forecasting. And then Mark Edmund Jones, again, a very, very important figure in the USA. And yeah, also very influenced by theosophy, but he tends to be known for most mechanical aspects of his astrology now. So he's credited with inventing chart shaping, for example, whereby if you just looked at the planets in a horoscope and nothing else, they cluster in different areas of the chart. They might all be below the horizon or above it, or they're all below and there's one above the horizon, or they're on two sides of the chart. And so you interpret that shape. So, you know, if you've got two groups of planets on either side of the chart, five planets on one side, five on the other, you'll say, oh, here's a person who's polarized between different possibilities. So in a way, sort of Mark Edmund Jones's contribution in the long run has become quite narrowed down, even though when he was alive, American astrologers regarded him as one of their really important figures. And of course, he's also known as being partly responsible for the Sabian symbols.
Right. So, I mean, why? I don't know if this is, it's not a rhetorical question, or I don't know if it's an obvious question, but why were all of these figures theosophists? I mean, I like the anecdote you shared earlier, because obviously it shows that there were some that weren't, but it's so notable and striking. It seems like that in the early 20th century, so many of these people who we regard as influential figures in the revival of astrology, that they were attached to this sort of philosophical or religious approach known as theosophy. I mean, is there a reason for that? I mean, that is probably notable, right?
It is notable. I'm just going to digress a minute and look at the wider context. Okay, this is an age in which a lot of people are revolutionary socialists. And the idea of overthrowing the political and economic order in order to create a socialist paradise is very current. A huge number of people are involved in it. And there are, of course, the great revolutions in Russia for example, and attempted revolutions elsewhere, including, you know, the USA. There's trade unions, there's demonstrations, there's strikes, there's intellectuals. Now, what, in my view, theosophy represents is a revolutionary tradition for people who actually question whether it's going to make any difference to challenge the political and economic order unless you change yourself first. And so, because theosophy predicts the coming of a new spiritual new age, it also does away with the capitalist system, with political borders and so on. You'll read this if you read what people said, the new age and the age of Aquarius is going to bring. It's going to be an end to political division, an end to economic injustice. So you've got theosophy offering a way forward to people who believed that the world needed to be reformed, but thought that change had to come from within. So that's part of its appeal. Now, quite a few of the people involved in theosophy really believed this, and we can quote Rudolf Steiner and Alice Bailey, both of whom have been responsible for generating innovatory kinds of astrology coming out of theosophy, astrology to do with, you know, the spirit. But there were others, like we could mention Charles Carter and Margaret Hone in England, and of course let's remember Sepharial, who were not, I think, the least bit interested in the coming of a spiritual new age. In fact, Charles Carter was quite dismissive of the idea. But that theosophical cosmos gave astrology a kind of value and a kind of justification. And let me give you an example of that. It comes from Alan Leo. Alan Leo was appalled by the injustice in the Britain that he grew up in, where some people were born into massive wealth and some people born into massive poverty through no choice of their own. And so he decided that the only reason for this had to be reincarnation. And so that then gave his astrology some importance, because your birth chart could enable you to look at who you were in this incarnation. And then the purpose of spiritual evolution then becomes both to prepare for the coming of the new age and ultimately your next incarnation. So we've got very much the importation of Indian ideas there. And I think that sense that theosophy gives astrology a value in an otherwise materialist, mechanical, scientific world is the reason why the Theosophical Society becomes this engine for generating astrology. It's got, you know, on the one hand, the revolutionaries put into it, the spiritual revolutionaries, and on the other hand, the people who don't want a revolution but still need some spiritual value in order to rationalize astrology in the new world. It's almost, you talked earlier, Chris, about how the cosmological changes in the 1600s undermined astrology. Well, I think what theosophy we've got going on is almost the restoration of a cosmology, a spiritual cosmology, to give astrology some rationale. So if scientists come along and say, well, astrology doesn't work because there's no gravitational influence that could enable it to work, and anyway, statistics show it doesn't work, the astrologers can say, no, you don't understand where we're coming from. And of course, where they're coming from is an alternate spiritual universe.
Right. That actually makes a ton of sense, because that would be a new element that would have been imported into Western astrology at that point, which is, you know, these Eastern ideas or Indian ideas of karma and reincarnation being imported into astrology via theosophy and become core concepts in Alan Leo's, core motivating concepts in Alan Leo's philosophy of astrology. And I could see how that would sort of reinvigorate or act as a sort of rallying point philosophically for creating a new cosmology around astrology in the early 20th century. And that explains why then it got so closely tied in with the New Age movement very early on in the early 20th century. And also, it's interesting just because those are concepts that would have been foreign or were not present if you go back a few centuries to, you know, William Lilly or people like that. They weren't talking about karma and reincarnation, but it really takes this core role in many of those early astrologers in the early 20th
century.
Well,
exactly. See, if you go back to Lilly's time, you couldn't talk about karma and reincarnation because in a Christian context, you only have one life. You know, they could still understand astrology very spiritually because, say, for example, you know, if you look at somebody's birth chart, say Lilly looks at a birth chart, he's still looking at the soul's incarnation in this life. And that's understood in the background. It's just that there's only the one life. When Alan Leo comes along and all the Indian ideas are flooding in, he's saying, actually, it makes sense in terms of many lives, and it explains the problem of injustice. Why am I born poor? Well, because I deserve it because of my last incarnation. Or because there's a lesson I need to learn. And actually, Chris, these ideas are very standard amongst modern astrologers. I did, in the late 90s and early 2000s, for a few years, I went around astrology conferences giving out questionnaires as part of my research. And amongst the questions I asked were, do you believe in reincarnation? And do you believe in karma? And about 70 to 80% of the people would tick, yes, I believe in reincarnation. And 70, 80% would tick, yes, I believe in karma. But when you look at the people who tick one or the other, because some people tick one and not the other, then it's in the high 90s. So belief in karma and reincarnation is one of the strongest beliefs amongst modern astrologers, certainly in the USA and Britain, which is where most of my research was done. It's just part of the culture.
So I guess in that sense, then, part of the revival of astrology in the 20th century has been a move towards, or has been part of, alternative sort of religious, basically an alternative religious lifestyle of having religious beliefs of some sort, but not having them be the more mainstream sort of Christian denominations that would have been more standard up to that point.
Yeah, that's right. I also did questions on my questionnaires to ask for religious affiliation. And what we find is a general tendency for many astrologers who are probably now in their 40s, 50s, 60s to have been born into a religious affiliation, you know, Roman Catholic, Episcopalian or something if they're in America and Britain, but then to have rejected it. And the option that most astrologers go for now in terms of their spiritual self-definition is what I call spiritual but non-aligned. And there's a wider phenomenon here that theorists of religion talk about, which is they call privatization. It's the process whereby in the Western world, it became increasingly popular for individuals to draw on different spiritual traditions and not to be part of any particular groups. There might be a little bit of, you know, esoteric Christianity there, you know, respect for Christ as a cosmic figure, bit of Buddhism, bit of Native American spirituality. And so people have their own spirituality. And this is that this sort of phenomenon is pretty important amongst astrologers. Again, I would say that if you asked astrologers if they, out of all the possible spiritual affiliations, if you asked them, does spiritual but not aligned fit? Most would say, yes, that suits me. So they're very spiritual, they're not moving away from religion at all, but they're moving away from, like so many people, from established and organized religion.
And is that sort of mix and match approach to religion and spirituality, is that the legacy of the Theosophists? I mean, I was reading a modern scholar on Gnosticism recently, and they actually made an interesting comment that I thought was funny and appropriate, where they were talking about Hermeticism around the first and second century CE. And they said it's basically like an ancient version of the modern New Age movement, in that Hermeticism was a patchwork of a bunch of different philosophical and religious ideas that were common or that were present in the ancient world in like Greco-Roman society at that point. And I thought that was an interesting external perspective to look at both Hermeticism in the ancient world, but also what the New Age movement represents in modern times. Do you think that's an outgrowth of Theosophy, or is that just a trend where there's always, you know, sometimes groups of people who mix different religious and spiritual ideas rather than just adhering to one specific approach?
Yeah, there is a continuous current of esoteric ideas which runs up to the modern New Age movement, back through Theosophy, back through Hermeticism, Gnosticism, and the literary origin of it in the Mediterranean world is the writings of Plato, who wrote, you know, he was very much concerned with the soul and its incarnation, and he believed in reincarnation. And the universe of Plato was based in consciousness rather than matter. You know, he was an idealist. Ideas came first, matter emerges out of ideas, which is the opposite of the dominant idea we have in the modern West. So there is a continuity. And of course, Blavatsky and Theosophy filtered and picked up on all those Hermetic and Gnostic ideas and reframed them for the late 19th century. But Chris, even then, when we look at organized religion, it's also very diverse. So you take a typical group of people, say, who might go to a Roman Catholic church. Those people might be exposed to all sorts of ideas that don't conform to what the Roman Catholic hierarchy thinks they should conform to. And I had a colleague who did one of the first PhDs on this area, where she looked at a group of churchgoers in the United Kingdom. And she found, of course, you know, they believe in ghosts, they might use astrology, all these things, you know, are just part of their worldview. And for them, there's no contradiction between that and being, say, a good Christian. And so there's this term now people use, or terms such as popular religion or vernacular religion or folk religion, to describe what people actually think and do rather than what church authorities anywhere say they should think and do. And there's an overlap here between, you get in the healing world. So you can get sort of Christian charismatic healing, where everybody's being healed by the Spirit. And the boundary between that world and New Age spiritual healing is so thin as sometimes to be non-existent. So, you know, you can, I know of instances where there's been Christian healing services, you know, attended by New Agers, tarot readers, and so on, because they see no distinction there. So, you know, if we look at the modern culture of astrology, then it actually, the boundaries, not just between different kinds of astrology, but between astrology and the rest of the world, are quite fluid. Which makes me think of Dane Rudgier, by the way, who you began this podcast talking about, because Dane Rudgier, who I think is as significant a figure in 20th century astrology as Alan Leo, was also an esoteric Christian and believed that the coming of the New Age, the Age of Aquarius, would be marked by what he saw as a rise of Christ consciousness. You know, and Christ being not the historical Jesus, but the pure cosmic light of Christ. So, you know, Dane Rudyard was, I think, very important because he also crossed boundaries. He innovated. He drew on this ancient Hermetic Gnostic teachings. He drew on Jung. And he innovated, but he also had this powerful belief that the New Age was coming. So I class him as one of the spiritual revolutionaries.
Yeah, and in our last episode, when we talked about Dane Rudyard, I was trying to, on the one hand, emphasize the importance of his role in probably being the final figure and maybe one of the more important figures in setting the philosophical and conceptual foundations for modern astrology. But I wasn't sure if I was almost going too far or if I wasn't going far enough in really emphasizing his role in doing that, especially in being one of the first people, as far as I'm aware, at least one of the first astrologers who really, as early as the 1930s in the astrology of personality, started incorporating Carl Jung's work on depth psychology into his astrology. I mean, where would you rank him? You would say that he's up there with Alan Leo in terms of being one of the most important and influential astrologers of the 20th century?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, a bit like Alan Leo, when he was young, people would not have seen him like this. And during his, you know, lifetime, he had his competitors. But, you know, history allows us to look, you know, sort of retrospectively. And we remember some people and forget others. And the people who we remember are those whose work is still current because people are still reading it and following it. So he's very important. And Jung's work had to be translated from German into English. And so it was picked up by German astrologers initially, unsurprisingly, and then was fed through slowly into the English-speaking world. I think we get the first astrologers being aware of it in the 1920s. And Rudyard was a devout theosophist, very convinced in the truth of theosophy. And I think he saw in the new depth psychology a very parallel school of thought to theosophy, because Jung, you know, drew, just like theosophists, he drew on Hermeticism and Gnosticism, even though Jung himself actually really didn't like theosophy at all. He thought the theosophists were shallow and didn't know what they were talking about. But actually, he's drawing on the same currents. And so Rudyard saw this, and I think for Rudyard, the depth psychologists provided a way of working with the deep psychic spiritual levels that theosophy dealt with. And if you read Alan Leo's books, some of them, his spiritual astrology, it's not that useful. And the same with Alice Bailey's astrology. It's difficult to read her books and then think, well, right now, how do I make use of this? Of course, Rudyard was also a very great student of Alice Bailey, so he's immersed in this theosophical world. And my view is that for him, then, people like Jung, Carl Rogers as well, their aim was to be practical. They were developing forms of therapy. They needed to see patients and treat people. So I think for Rudyard, they gave this practical edge, which, you know, theosophy lacked. What theosophy could do was say, here's something about astrology, if you just think about yourself. But the depth psychologists answered the question of now, how do I actually make use of this for somebody else as a professional astrologer?
Sure. And one of the questions that came up in our episode on Rudyard is he was so prolific. He wrote something like between 30 and 50 books in his life, plus, you know, hundreds of articles. And I actually I was having a hard time thinking of another astrologer who is more prolific than Rudyard, which made me sort of tentatively want to say he might have been the most prolific astrologer ever or that I'm aware of. Do you know anyone that's more prolific in terms of their astrological output than Rudyard, or am I sort of overplaying that a little bit?
No, he was certainly very prolific. I'm going to give you a little anecdote, though, there, just to a bit of a sort of cheeky anecdote. Ronald Davidson, who was in the late 70s the president of the Astrological Lodge of the Theosophical Society in London, and, you know, he'd been around for a long time, the 20s, 30s, 40s. He knew everybody. And he once said, with a slightly mischievous twinkle in his eye, that Dane Rudyard was paid by the word, and that accounted for his prolific output. So there's a little bit of sort of intra-theosophical gossip. So perhaps he was paid by the word. I don't know. But he was certainly prolific, and yes, you can easily acquire a shelf full of his books.
Right, yeah. I had heard something similar from a bookseller once who told me that, and we talked about it a little bit on the last episode because it seems to be especially more prominent in his early works, like The Astrology of Personality, where he's just very, very wordy. And if that was patched together partially from older articles that he'd written, then that kind of makes sense to some extent. But the last thing about Rudyard before we move on is just, I was curious because I can't tell... He wrote a lot of books through his lifetime, but I can't really see if he was sort of popular right away. It almost doesn't seem like he really was that popular until that new generation of astrologers came in the 1960s and 70s, and then suddenly he was really in his heyday. Is that true? Was his influence really mainly towards the end of his life, even though he was writing since the 1930s, or was his influence already felt at an earlier date?
He definitely became, I think, the astrologer of the 60s counterculture. Because, of course, he was in California in the heyday of the 60s. You know, the Summer of Love, he was involved. He was giving lectures. And so I think that is when he entered his stride. I've got another anecdote here, Chris, that... this is what I was told by Alexander Ruperti. Okay, so Alexander Ruperti was a Swiss astrologer who was one of Dane Rudyard's leading students and promoters. Ruperti was also a student of Alice Bailey. So when Ruperti was young in 1936, as an eager young astrologer, he was on the committee of the Astrological Lodge of the Theosophical Society in London. And the president of the society was Charles Carter. And so Ruperti got hold of a copy of the Astrology of Personality and took it along and showed it to Charles Carter. And I paraphrase what Ruperti told me, but it was something like Charles Carter said to me to go away and not to be such a silly young boy. Because, you know, Carter's astrology was quite technical. He loved devising new aspects and this kind of thing. And he took a look at Rudyard's work and just thought it was all, you know, just verbiage. So poor young Alexander Ruperti, disillusioned, left the lodge committee, never to return. But I think he told me this when he was in his 80s, that I could tell it still rankled that he'd had this put down. So yes, I think this there's always a paradigm shift, isn't there? You know, an older generation of astrologers like Charles Carter had to pass on, and then Rudyard entered his stride. And actually, I suspect that right of his it would have been in the 60s that Rudyard also would have began to make a splash in theosophical circles in the UK as well. But yeah, he definitely rose to prominence. So by the time of his death in 1985, he was you know, the patriarch of astrology in the English-speaking world. For a time, it had been him and Mark Edmund Jones. Then Mark Edmund Jones died, and it was just Rudyard as this great figure. And I think there is no doubt he is extremely influential, because he came up with certain handy catchphrases, such as person-centered astrology. It's a very catchy phrase that astrology is centered on the person and their needs, not on what their horoscope says about them. And so, you know, like Alan Leo, Rudyard thought you could make definite astrological predictions, but only for people whose lives are dominated by fate. As soon as people developed any kind of self-awareness, there's no point in making predictions for them, because the predictions wouldn't come true because people are directing their lives. So Rudyard helps engineer a shift where there's a kind of professional astrological consultancy which moves away from telling the client you're like this because you've got a Moon-Saturn square and you're going to have an unhappy marriage and get divorced, and moves away from that into talking to the person about how they're feeling and the state of their life, and then reflecting on that through the symbolism of Moon-Saturn. It's a different approach, and that's a process which was underway, but Rudyard became almost the person who helped sort of steer that process. And so out of that, we get all the modern astrological counseling techniques.
Right. And that really takes off during the explosion of popularity in astrology with the younger generations in the 1960s and 70s as part of the counterculture movement and the New Age movement. And then that's also complemented with, we have the invention of the sun sign column earlier, around the 1940s and afterwards, its subsequent popularization of sun sign astrology, which people are sometimes surprised to hear what a relatively recent concept that is, not necessarily the idea of a sun sign, but the emphasis on that and the use of that in a sort of forecasting column in a newspaper is actually a 20th century development, more or less, right?
Yes, it is. And develops around 1930. You're right, Chris. The idea of a zodiac sign is 2,500 years old. But the idea of the 12-paragraph horoscope column develops in the 1930s. And we got two strands to this development. On the one hand, there's the development of the newspaper astrology column, which begins in the 1930s in England. And it begins with forecasts for the days of the week. Not the zodiac sign. The zodiac sign and the horoscope column, in that sense, I think, develops in American Astrology, so a magazine for astrologers, edited by Paul Clancy. And there is even a possibility that Rudyard wrote some columns. For a while, I thought that maybe he'd come up with the whole concept, but I wouldn't agree with that now. He may have written some columns anonymously in American Astrology. And it then takes off. And interestingly, you get it. It has, for a while, there's a little bit of uncertainty about it, particularly in Britain. What happens in Britain is that, and elsewhere in Europe, is that in the 1940s, in the Second World War, newsprint becomes very expensive. And so newspapers shrink in size. So they cut out the astrology. And the astrology doesn't return until the early 50s, after the newsprint rationing is over. So you've got a continuity in America from the 1930s, and the rest of Europe, really gets going about 1954, 55. It's that recent. And so by the time in the 60s, you've got everybody saying, introducing themselves, you know, hey man, what's your sign? I'm a Libra. It's only 10 years in the mid-60s since in Europe the horoscope column became an established part of popular culture. So, and then it gets going, and then you have the publication of some mega books, and in particular Linda Goodman's Sun Signs around, when is that, around 1969, 68, 69?
Yeah, I think it was 1968, and that is the highest selling, the best selling astrology book of all time at this point. I mean, I guess we don't have, you know, sales numbers on Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos, but even despite that, I would think Linda Goodman's book, which sold millions and millions of copies, probably is the highest selling astrology book of all time, right?
Yeah, I mean, she took a format which was not particular to her, and she, like so many people, you know, pick up a format, give it a new spin. And of course, the thing about her book is it's got this huge popular appeal because you can read about with Aries, not just what Aries is like, but your Aries boss, your Aries child, you know, your Aries partner. And that personalized it and particularized it. But the one way I've talked about sun sign astrology is it domesticates the universe. And there's a parallel with what's happening in the rest of cosmology. So in the late 20s, you get the idea of the expanding universe. Suddenly the universe is bigger than it ever was before, and it's getting bigger. And there's hundreds of galaxies, thousands of galaxies, and we're just this tiny speck. So the scientific cosmology and astronomy creates this huge universe, and suddenly astrology domesticates it. And so you'll see this in some of the early columns in the 1930s. They're talking about Mr. and Mrs. Taurus and Mr. and Mrs. Libra. And it suddenly becomes, you can imagine Mr. and Mrs. Taurus sitting at home in their armchair in front of the fire. And Linda Goodman takes that domestication and turns into a global phenomenon. So anybody can buy her book and they can think, oh, you know, my teenager's behaving very badly, and they're a Virgo. So you look up, you know, my Virgo teenager, for example. So, yeah, the domestication of the universe is the way I see it.
Brilliant. I like that. So at this point, we just have this the convergence of all these different threads, which leads to an explosion of popularity in astrology in the 1960s and 70s. It's part of the counterculture movement and the New Age movement. And then the aftermath is just sort of this flourishing of astrology in the last quarter and in the second half of the 20th century, essentially, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, we get the development of the web. So I did my doctoral research beginning 20 years ago on the extent and nature of contemporary belief in astrology. And back then, everything was still in print. Newspapers, you know, magazines, I asked people what they read, and I read what they read, and that's what it was all based on. And if you wanted your horoscope done, you went to see an astrologer. The highest tech thing the astrologer might do would be record the consultation onto a cassette tape. But I don't think anybody really knows really what's happening with astrology at the moment, because like so many other things in our culture, it's all over cyberspace and the web, and cyberspace and the World Wide Web and the related technology are changing every week. So there is astrologers out there with, you know, YouTube channels and you with your podcast and so on. So it's really in a new phase at the moment that I think no one's really got a handle on, which is not unusual because there's so many other things about our modern world that we're constantly trying to catch up with.
Sure. And I think, I mean, if you compared this time period now, or let's say the late 20th century. I mean, I think I saw most of the recent polls. I don't know what the accuracy of this is, but usually it seems like when public polls are done, it usually says something like 25% of people in society, quote unquote, believe in astrology, you know, whatever that means. How would that compare to, like, let's say the 17th century? I mean, would that be comparable? Have we seen a return to something comparable to what it was back then? Or does it still pale in comparison, even though it's been a revival from, let's say, what it was in the 18th and 19th century?
The problem is, Chris, that those polls don't make sense because they're trying to quantify something in binary terms, which is very fluid and nuanced. So you ask somebody, you know, do you believe in astrology or not? To start off with, people answer questions like that, partly in terms of who's asking the question, but also, you know, what is astrology? If you said to people, do you believe an astrologer can predict the date that your child is going to get married? They'd probably say no. But if you say to people, do you think that the characteristics of your zodiac sign have some relationship to your personality, then a lot of people are going to say yes. So those figures of 25%, they're mainly Gallup poll figures, and they don't really stand up to scrutiny. They're attempts to, like, quantify qualitative life. So I would say now that if we're looking at how levels of belief in astrology fluctuate, it always depends what you mean by astrology. Because back in the 1700s, then the casting of horoscopes had pretty much died out. But the idea that there were lunar effects on one's mood was standard medicine. You know, hence the term lunatic. Certainly for much of the 18th century. So it always depends what you're asking about. So my view is that astrology is part of popular culture, but there are many different ways for astrologers to practice it, and many different ways for everybody to understand it.
Sure. Would you say in some sort of broader sense from a societal standpoint that there has been a resurgence in different beliefs in astrology or different practices of astrology in the late 20th, let's say the second half of the 20th century compared to prior to that, or compared to the 19th or 18th century?
Yes, because we had the development of the horoscope column as a means for people to, as a way of developing a new language of astrology. Now, here again, Chris, what people haven't looked at, perhaps it's because it's too difficult now, is to see what effect almanacs had throughout the 19th century on people's understanding of astrology. You know, if astrological material is being disseminated through almanacs, you might find, if you talk to people, most of the population in the 19th century believed in astrology. So I think what we've got to focus on is different forms of astrology. So we've clearly got in the 20th century a big revival in the casting of horoscopes. But even so, you know, it's still a very, very tiny, tiny practice that engages a very tiny number of people. So I would look at other ways in which astrology has changed. And so, for example, I think it's very influential. I think Jung's very influential. So, for example, Jung makes astrology respectable amongst a whole class of person. You know, a lot of the people who might otherwise not be interested in astrology, but who are very interested in a Jungian approach to the world, which includes astrology. So, the picture is complex and constantly shifting. So yeah, we can talk generally about a revival of astrology in the 20th century. When we begin to look at how that revival works and what it is, then it all gets, it gets, you know, we see diversity and we see complexity.
Sure. But we at least end up in a situation where through those many different influences and different threads, you have things like, you know, some psychologists in practice who might follow Jung using astrology in psychological settings, or we have it influencing sort of politics, for example, where you get figures like Joan Quigley, you know, advising the president of the United States and working with his schedule using astrological matters, which is sort of a return to, you know, the situation in the Roman Empire where you have astrologers serving a similar advisory capacity, or other little ways in which astrology suddenly sort of appeared in somewhat prominent ways in different aspects of society in this kind of strange and interesting way.
Yeah. And of course, actually, talk about Joan Quigley reminds me of something else about modern astrology, which is that you've got a much stronger appeal to women than to men. So if you go to a meeting of your local astronomy club, it'll be 90%, if not 100% men. If you go to a meeting of a local astrology group, it'll be 75-80% women. It's my impression. And so I think another way to think about what modern Western astrology does often is it gives a voice to women. You know, it's a cliche in our society that men won't talk about their feelings, but women do. And so I think that often astrology can provide a very handy language for that discussion about feelings and about a universe of feelings and about a universe which acknowledges, you know, emotion as and relationship as, you know, important, central to human life.
Sure. And I mean, that's probably one of the biggest differences and changes in 20th century astrology prior to earlier is suddenly we have, you know, astrology books, major astrology books that are being penned by women. Whereas prior to the 20th century, if you go back, you know, typically most of the most influential astrological texts were written by men. And then all of a sudden in the early 20th century, you get figures like Elsbeth Eberton in Germany, or you have Evangeline Adams in the US, who's like an early, I guess like Margaret Hone would be a influential figure in the UK, right?
Oh, absolutely. Margaret Hone, modern textbook of astrology, very influential. For me, that book is now a really important historical text. It was the teaching book for the Faculty of Astrological Studies for about 30 years, when the Faculty of Astrological Studies was doing the most sort of high-profile distance learning course, again, in the English-speaking world. So you could go to classes in London, you could study the course distance learning in America, and Margaret Hone's textbook was the standard book. So yes, a woman who helped shape a generation of astrologers.
Right. And that kind of acts as a nice segue then into the final sort of question that I had for you, or final topic, which is just part of the aftermath of the flourishing of astrology in the late 20th century, is that you have actually been part of a movement to develop, even though astrology fell out of academia centuries ago as a respectable study, and there used to be like chairs for astrology at major universities, and that's no longer the case. You have been part of a movement to bring astrology back as a respectable topic of study from a historical standpoint, that since this is such an important facet of culture and of history and society, to say that this is something that's worthwhile and that needs to be studied in an academic context from a historical standpoint, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It always has astonished me that there are some academics who've said that some subjects and disciplines and practice should not be topics of academic study. So, what we do in the master's degree and the other teaching that I run is, you know, we look at the whole wide range of people, how people relate to the sky is the way I define it. The sky is a theatrical backdrop to people's lives. But in very specific instances, that does deal with the philosophy, practice, claims, language, beliefs, ideas, and lineage of astrology. And we could deal with any culture and any time period as well.
So why is that important? Yep. Or from an academic perspective, why is it important to study the history of astrology?
Because in present times, it's because it's part of the culture of our society and quite a widespread culture. And also if we look at India or China, as China emerges out of the communist world, and non-communist Chinese people always had a very strong lineage of astrology. And of course, in India, it's such a central part of culture. But if we look back to the past, then because the pre-17th century idea of the world was one in which the terrestrial and celestial environments are totally integrated, you know, stars, planets, people, all part of a single system, that astrology did have a lot to say about politics. It was had a lot to say about history. It was a topic for artists, for writers. It has religious overtones and uses. And so to understand its history, its claims, its philosophy is really important for understanding the background of Western culture and how, therefore, Western culture got to where it is now.
Sure, and it shows up in so many different areas of society that it provides an access point for understanding those things, whether it's like the arts. Like, I know there's been work on like Shakespeare's use of astrology in plays in a literary context. There's the political context of studying, you know, political figures or astrologers who influenced political figures like Joan Quigley in the United States in the 1980s, or going back to the first century in the Roman Empire, Emperor Tiberius and his work with the astrologer Thrasyllus. I guess we've talked a lot in this episode about the influence of astrology on Carl Jung, and that in and of itself could provide a whole study in terms of his psychology or the ways in which that did or did not influence his approach to psychology. So it's really studying astrology partially as an access point for understanding culture and cultural developments better in some sense.
Yes, it is. In fact, you mentioned Jung. I mean, we've got in my master's program, we've got 9 modules. One of them is called Sky and Psyche. So it deals with astrological inferences on psychology and psychological inferences on astrology, you know, as cultural phenomena, as ideas, as practices. And so we do actually have essay questions on Jung's astrology in that module. So yeah, we'll deal with, you know, anything from the ancient to the modern. And it brings alive a part of culture, a part of understanding the human relationship with the cosmos, which I think is tragically ignored. You know, it's part of life, part of culture, part of what people think and do on this planet. So it's really great to have, and I think it's important to be able to look at it.
Sure, that makes sense. And from the perspective of, let's say, you know, people listening to this show, so practicing astrologers, why would they want to study the history of astrology, or what is important about doing that that might be, you know, useful from an insider perspective?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people practice astrology as a craft. It's something they do. They can do horoscopes for their family, their friends, their clients. It's very much something that they do. It's a practice. But for quite a number, they develop a need to reflect on their own practice. And that means finding out about the philosophy of astrology, the claims of astrology, you know, its background, its context. Let me give you, you know, an example. you know, the way in which astrologers read horoscopes often comes with a whole set of understandings about the relationship between, you know, fate, free will, for example. Well, where those ideas came from and how they fit into wider currents of thought is not really dealt with by teachers of astrology and astrological schools. So, you know, Rudyard has a particular view of how people choose their lives and what they do. Jung had one. More mechanical, fated astrologers have them. And these ideas can be traced back to classical Greece, and they've been influenced by modern Indian ideas, as we've talked about. So I've known quite a few practicing astrologers who get the point where they think, oh, I really want to know about where those ideas that I'm using and articulating and relying on to interpret horoscopes, where those ideas come from. What exactly is it that I'm doing when I look at somebody's birth chart and say, well, you've got, you know, the sun here, the moon there, and a transit of that planet. What am I actually thinking about and saying when I do that? So I think that's what the program offers to astrologers, is that wider sort of scholarly, reflective environment.
Sure. So if a person's interested in studying the history of astrology in an academic setting or in a more serious or rigorous way, where can they go? I mean, could you tell us a little bit about the program that you run?
Yeah, the program, it's at the University of Wales, Trinity St. David. We call the program Cultural Astronomy and Astrology. And the reason we use both words is because until the 17th century in Europe, there was no distinction between the idea of measuring a planet or wondering a star or wondering what it was made of and attributing meaning to it. And we are just, we have 9 different modules. I think in America you'd call them classes. And students take 6 of them and then go on from there and write a 15,000-word dissertation based on personal research. And so the different areas we deal with in the modules, what we teach the whole philosophical background we look at fate, magic, divination, classical philosophy, modern philosophy, how they all provide context for understanding astrology. We look at astral religion, including in India and non-Western cultures. So we might look at sacred calendars, astrological imagery and pilgrimages. We've got a module where we look at, as I said, sky and psyche. We look at Jung. We look at ideas of sacred space and place. We've got a great module we call Heavenly Discourses, where the students actually have to keep a sky journal. One of the briefs of the module is to go out over a period of a month every day and watch the sky and then write a reflexive sky journal. So it's a pretty innovatory program, and we're just about to start within that a separate certificate on the history of astrology that would consist of 3 modules alone. It's all distance learning. We teach using webinars, and it's a postgraduate degree, so it's a master's degree. And there's a wonderfully flexible feature of the British educational system. You can enroll on a academic program at master's level without having a bachelor's degree, because we recognize that people acquire all sorts of life experience and skills that can fit them for master's level study. So, you know, we're open to applications from a wide range of people. We have people who could just start and do one module. You know, they don't want to do the whole program, just take one module and maybe go on and do another a bit later. So we have, you know, flexible learning structures as well. But ours is the only course in the world that actually teaches this subject.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put a link where people can find out more information about that program on the description page for this episode at theastrologypodcast.com. And in terms of other resources for studying the history of astrology, you've had a huge output over the course of the past decade of astrology books, starting with your definitive two-volume series on the history of Western astrology titled A History of Western Astrology, Volume 1 and Volume 2, I think around 2008 and 2009. And then since then, you've published several other books recently as well, right?
Yep, there was Astrology and Cosmology in the World's Religions, which is New York Press. And that book takes a different culture, you know, the Americas, Australia, Polynesia, because I wanted to get away from the idea that astrology is a Western phenomenon, or perhaps something people also do in India as well. I wanted to say, look, actually, every culture has a way of looking at the sky, the stars, the planets, and relating them to human life. And so that was that book. And then I did another book, Astrology and Popular Religion in the Modern West, that looks at my modern research, goes into what modern astrologers believe. That's where I talk about the belief in karma and reincarnation and so on. My most recent book actually was about utopian ideas and New Age ideas with no astrology in it. But, you know, belief in the coming New Age, Age of Aquarius, those occur. And I actually did have a little bit of a look at the history of the development of belief in the Aquarian Age, which did actually have quite an impact on the way people thought in the 60s and the development of the counterculture. So yeah, I'm prolific.
Yeah, you're getting quite up there. I don't know. You might be able to reach Dane Rudyard, but I'm not sure if you might fall slightly short. But
yeah, I think I'm running out of words at the moment. Actually, I'm not going to equal Rudyard. He's going to keep his place.
Sure. For now, I don't know. I mean, a history of Western astrology was quite a tome. I mean, that is the definitive book or two volume series on the history of astrology at this point, as far as I'm concerned or anyone else is concerned. So definitely, I think people could check out volume 2 of that, especially as a sort of companion to this discussion, where you go into much more detail about just about every area that we talked about today. And then also Astrology and Popular Religion in the Modern West also has a lot of great treatments of different topics that we touched on in passing here in this podcast. So I'd recommend people check those out. I'll put links to them on the description page for this episode. But yeah, thanks a lot for joining me today, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Great, Chris. It's been really good talking to you.
All right, you too. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.